caterpillar, and in fact, was killed. The Israeli soldier said, whoops, it was an accident. Gosh, really? And there's been no formal inquiry at all into that. So that is the story. I hope that was the question. And that closes out our hour here, Crystal.
And we go out with in the memory of a woman hero who was killed 2 years ago.
And I want to also just honor the memory of Subcomandante Ramona, who just passed away in January, one of the original Zapatista strategy people and organizers. Also to our dear friends and KBOO volunteers who have passed in the last year, Jan Schaefer and Ann Rose Pierce. Blessings.
Yes. Well, it's been a wonderful, wonderful morning. Thank you, everyone.
A minha bandeira é verde amarela. Gabriela,
Gabriela,
Gabriela.
My name is Judy Feistel, and I'm talking today with Lynn Taylor and Tina Tao McMahon. The song you just heard, Rosie the Riveter, is quite apropos to our subject today. 25 years ago, Tina and Lynn were part of an oral history project that documented the stories of the local women shipyard workers during World War II. These stories have been presented in videotape format called Good Work Sister, and just now has been reissued in DVD. Welcome to KBOO, Lynn and Tina.
Thank you,
Judy.
Can you tell us about what this project is about?
Well, this was a chance for the women in the Northwest Women's History Project, which we were part of over 25 years ago, to meet with women who had worked in the shipyards in Portland and Vancouver during World War II, and for them to tell their stories about doing the kind of work that women had never been allowed to do before.
It was very important because these women were quite old by now, and it was important that we got their stories down. In fact, one of the women said to us when we came to her door, just brilliantly, she opened the door and said, "Honey, I thought I would die before someone would hear my story." So that was really why we did this.
And how did the project come about then?
Amy Kesselman, who was one of the founding members, was working on a doctoral dissertation on this subject, the women shipyard workers of World War II in Portland and Vancouver. And she was teaching a class at Portland State, and one of our other members, Madeline Moore, was in that, and they got an idea that they would do this as a larger project and invite other women to join. And so Lynn and I and six or seven other women joined, and we met every Monday night for dinner for 4 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it was an incredible process of trying to figure out exactly what we were going to do, and then putting ads in newspapers to locate the women, and doing screening interviews over the phone with about 200 women shipyard workers, and then narrowing that down to 30 that we went and did in-depth interviews with photography and tape, which we then used in the show.
I think all of us were intrigued and interested in the project because we all had some connection with oral history, relationships with grandparents. You know, there was some interest why we all got together when we did. And the other thing that's important to know is that we made every decision collectively. For 4 years, we had dinner together every Monday night, as Tina said, and every word that we put in the show was decided by all of us. Every picture was decided by all of us. Every music interlude was decided by all of us. We really had a lot of practice in working with collective decision-making during those 4 years.
It was very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot of good food. That's always important.
A lot of good food, a lot of interrupting.
Yes,
it was very fun.
I think to this day, any of us could eat dinner at anyone's house and recognize who cooked it.
So you had said this woman who... You came to her door, and she says she never thought that anybody would be asking her her story. What was the story that she wanted so much to share? Maybe not that particular woman, but what were the types of stories that you heard?
Well, mostly it was because this particular woman, I think she was in her late 80s when we interviewed her in 1979, and she had never done anything independently from her husband and children her entire life. So the act to actually go out of the house and get a job at all was quite novel for her, and the fact that she loved it. And she lived in a rural community, which was also... she was the only one of her colleagues that had done this kind of act, and that ultimately her husband was supportive of her, and her kids thought it was kind of an interesting situation, and they were quite proud of her as she took this first step. But basically the stories that we got were over and over again how people basically walked out on a limb to do this. You know, they didn't get a lot of backing from anybody. They just one day got up, got dressed, went to get to work in the shipyards, applied for a job, and got them. And you know, many women were flabbergasted in those first waves. You know, that they were amazed that they got a job, and then they were amazed that they started welding, and then they were even amazed how much they loved welding, or, you know, or other jobs during the shipyard days.
And amazed at how well they got paid.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big feature. They kept saying, well, you know, I could have gotten, you know, so much working at Meyer & Frank or, you know, as a clerk, and, you know, I could make 10 times as much in the shipyard.
Yeah.
And so a lot of women saved enough money to buy a home, or, you know, it made a significant financial difference in their lives over the long haul,
mm-hmm.
just working 3 or 4 years, whatever they worked in the shipyards.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying how this woman, it was so out of character to go and get a job like this in the traditional men's roles type of jobs, especially. And did she then, after the war, just went back being a housewife?
She did, and I think she was one of the older women in the group. So, you know, I think she just, at that time, the jobs were very difficult to maintain once they got them, even though women wanted to keep them. There's a story of one of the women in the show who's welding a pipe, and the war is over, all the blasts are going off, and everyone's celebrating, and somebody says to her
nickname was Shorty.
Shorty, yeah. Her supervisor comes in and says, "Hey, Shorty, you can, you know, stop welding that pipe. The war is over. You can finish that pipe tomorrow." And she said, "I think I'm going to go in and finish this pipe. This is the last pipe I'm ever going to weld." And he said, "Don't be silly. You'll finish that tomorrow." And she went back in and finished finished the pipe. And sure enough, she was laid off the next day. All the women in the department were laid off the next day.
Hmm.
So they knew. They knew that time was limited for them.
It was a window for them then.
Mm-hmm.
There was one quote that I read in some of the reading material. It was by Bernice Thompson, and she said, "My husband was from Kentucky. He didn't think women knew anything, so I showed him."
Yeah.
She was great. She was a black woman, and she was so proud of having had that experience and being able to, you know, show her husband what women could do.
We heard that over and over again, actually. That was, if there was, there were a couple common themes, and that clearly was one of them, that, you know, we showed them we could do it, and we could do more than what we thought we could do.
Yeah.
And you mentioned how the women came forward, you know, sort of just walked out of their houses. There was some media campaign to get women to be working in the shipyards at the time. Do you know about what that was about?
Yeah, there were actually lots of media postcards and posters, not postcards, but posters that were interesting because we had them in the show, and what we noticed about them was that the men were big and strong, and they were saying, you know, get your sister and wife and cousin and daughter to come work in the shipyards or whatever. And the picture of the women was kind of shy and meek and quiet. And it was an interesting dichotomy of, you know, come on and work, but the picture of the woman was still kind of backed away. And then as the war went on and the posters got stronger, the women got stronger in the posters. So it was an interesting process how
so
women
get
were
the
depicted
classic
in art.
Rosie the Riveter poster, mm-hmm, and the we can do it poster with the, you know, the strong woman with her lunch bucket. But it was a powerful campaign, propaganda campaign, to get women to take those jobs. And then the campaign reversed itself immediately when, mm-hmm, the war was over. And, you know, the man's coming home, and it's time for the boys to have their jobs back.
Mm.
You know, the big magazine articles, mm-hmm, and about cooking and, you know, going back to what you really wanted to do anyway.
Well, we noticed that the piece that was interesting about the magazines was that during the war, the magazines like Ladies Home Journal and Red Book and, you know, sort of the classic women's, traditional women's magazines had recipes that were quick and fast, you know, the 5-minute dinner, the 10-minute dinner, while the women were working. And as soon as the war was over and those jobs were lost, those same recipes became 35 and 45 minutes long.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Were some of the women you spoke to, were they resentful, or they were resigned that this was going to be just a short-lived project?
Well, they were all over the map. A lot of them were very content, I think, to follow the cultural stream and go back to the lives they'd have before with this kind of new confidence. Some of them did keep industrial jobs. Mm-hmm. A few of them did stay. And, you know, they'd found work they really loved to do and managed to continue to do it and became crane operators or continued to be welders. That was a few of them. Some of them were resentful or kind of amused, sort of, what can you do? Would have liked to have stayed and done it longer. But, you know, that obviously wasn't going to happen.
I think, yeah, I agree with Tina. People really were all over the map. But the other thing that was also important was that everybody really appreciated the experience, even if it ended quickly, even if they had mixed emotions following it. You know, they were all so happy that they did it, that they did it at all.
And they were so thrilled to tell somebody about it.
Yes.
Yeah, it was as if this experience had happened in limbo, and they were not ever going to have a chance to say what it had meant to them, how it had transformed them. I think one of the ways I look at it is these are the mothers of the present-day feminists, and that experience gave them something which they then gave to their daughters.
It was interesting. We had a debut of the show, Good Work Sister, January in 1981. And I don't know if anybody remembers, but that was the year we had an ice storm in January of 1981. And in fact, we had an ice storm the day of the debut. And we were holding the debut of the show at the Georgia Room in Meyer and Frank, which was really the lunch spot of many of those women. And oddly enough, people came early to the show. We didn't think anybody would even make it because the weather was bad, the roads were bad, and people came early before the Georgia Room was even open. And it was filled to capacity, and everybody was dressed up and excited. And women were calling to each other. They hadn't seen each other in 40 years. So there was, not only did they see the show together, and were talking during it because they remembered so much of the pieces. But they were standing up and calling to each other and reuniting with each other. And that, to me, was just amazing. We just felt like that was really quite an unexpected gift to all of us to see that.
Yeah, that was sheer joy.
I want to go back just for a couple of minutes to some of the content that you covered in the stories. And one thing that had been alluded to was that there were some myths about who these women were. You know, that they were literally housewives and they got up and they left. And issues regarding sexism and racism that were experienced by these workers. Can either of you talk about that?
Well, I don't know where we want to start with that. You know, I think I want to jump in again prior to those topics and talk about what the Kaiser shipyards did around child care issues. Because as soon as the women started to work in the workforce, it became very clear that if they had small children at home, they weren't going to be able to do the work that they needed to do and have the shift work that they needed to have. So within no time at all, Kaiser built these wonderful child care facilities, almost on-site child care facilities for the kids ranging in all ages. And then they also added a meal program so that at the end of women's shifts, they could order the evening meal or whatever meal they needed, but they could literally order an evening meal, finish their shift, come pick up their child and have their hot meal waiting for them and go home. And it was interesting because, obviously, look how much easier your work life would be if you had all of those things taken care of for you. And what was particularly interesting also was that as soon as the war was over, the shipyard child care service closed.
Well, it also attests, too, that the women, even though they were working this very hard and arduous job, they were going home to more work.
Yes, it was.
And the dinner was something that the company could help them out with.
Yeah, the dinner was something they were still responsible for, but the company supported them, you know, in a pretty radical way. It was wonderful.
And then in terms of the individual, you know, there was certainly sexual harassment on the jobs. There were certainly issues of racism on the jobs. The kinds of things that happen in normal work sites, unfortunately, also happened there. You know, many women spoke of the sexual harassment that they were facing in the workplace, and then they'd go to their supervisor to complain, and that wouldn't help at all because the supervisor would be part of that. And so they learned, some women figured out that they just needed to be quiet. Other women decided not to be quiet. I mean, there were different responses for different situations, but every issue that could happen in a workplace happened there as well.
Yeah, one woman brought her hammer down on the guy's hard hat and
that's right.
Knocked him off the ladder, and that was the last time he grabbed her ankle, I guess, or anyone did. Yeah, there was definitely a problem with racism. Families were encouraged to come here to Portland and Vancouver from the South with the promise of high-paying jobs, and then they would get here and the jobs would not actually be open to them, black families. The only jobs that the black women could get might be the janitorial jobs. I don't know if this is true in every case, but the unions wouldn't be necessarily open to African-American women, or, you know, they would say, well, there aren't any welding jobs. And she could say, well, there are jobs, but they're just not open to me. That was definitely a problem that we were able to, you know, document and hear about. And that's in the show.
Each of you did some of the interviewing. You divided amongst those 12 of you who were involved with putting this whole project together.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't go out on any of the actual interviews in people's homes. I did phone interviewing and work on the show itself. Did you go out?
I went out and did the interviews in people's homes as well. When we went out and interviewed in people's homes, we went in pairs, so there were two of us, and it was really quite wonderful to do. It's a wonderful experience to be there.
Well, for those of you who just tuned in, I'm speaking with Tina Tell McMahon and Lynn Taylor, and they took part in the documenting of the stories of women who worked in the shipyards during World War II in the Portland and Vancouver area. And these stories have just been re-released in a DVD format called Good Work Sister. What is that reference, Good Work Sister?
That was the line on one of the war recruiting posters to get women to go into the shipyards. And we talked a lot about what to name the show. Yeah. But that sprang out finally as the,
stuck.
As the title. Yeah,
yeah.
It stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you put out the video, this was in 82, that the video originally was put together with archived images from the war of the women working in these industries and strictly from the Portland and Vancouver area. That's what Good Work Sister is drawing from, correct?
Yes.
And, I was really taken by these images because what I've seen from those times is more the feminized image of women and not women with overalls and the welding guns and up on the platforms and all this kind of activity that is necessary when you're in a shipbuilding yard. Do you want to discuss how these images were chosen? Were they hard to find?
One of us went to Washington, D.C., Karen, and looked through the National Archives to get historic photos and historical posters. And the Oregon Historical Society was very helpful. Mm-hmm. They had lots of wonderful photographs. Some of the women shared photographs with us. The show has a combination of historical photographs, really wonderful ones, and photographs of the women as we interviewed them, present-day photographs of them. General historical footage, posters, as well as, you know, material about the times that mm-hmm. isn't necessarily Portland and Vancouver, but the pictures of the women in the yards were local pictures, and the interviews are all local.
Once we had all the pictures together, we all decided together. Again, every decision was collective. Which pictures to put in, and it was quite interesting to come to those, because we made decisions for lots of different reasons, and there were so many wonderful photos, and we really felt like we could capture the whole period. And it's amazing how you can capture an entire period in 20 minutes. I mean, I still think it's remarkable.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I mean, there were 140 images in the show, and originally it was a slideshow, and then it became a video, and now it's DVD. And that it took us 4 years to produce this 20-minute piece of you know, media production that's 20 minutes long was astounding in a way. But each image was chosen for its power. And so, mm-hmm. It's a 20-minute show, but it has a lot of power.
Well, you keep talking about how everything was done so collectively. So it's sort of like there's two stories here almost. The story of the women whose stories you were covering in terms of the time of World War II, but then there's your guys' stories. And, you know, I know lately I've been hearing a lot of thing about girl aggression stuff and getting into the workplace and then how women aren't working cooperatively together. And I personally never had those kinds of experiences myself, and it seems like this project is also a testament of women working well together. I'm sure you've had your moments during the 4 years, I would imagine, but
it is a testament to that, because we had a lot of fun, and we did manage to collaborate, and we did have the patience to continue this thing for 4 years. And a lot of it was our commitment to the women that we were interviewing, and the sense of responsibility to them, and love for them, and a desire to honor their stories, and a sense that time was running out for them. That was key. We all had that. But we loved each other.
Mm-hmm.
We still do. We don't see each other very much, but we get together and laugh.
Oh, that's true. When we last, I think we've periodically had a few reunions to just keep ourselves all together. And the first reunion that we had after not seeing each other for several years, I think we laughed nonstop for close to 2 hours. And we used to do that regularly, and we were so thrilled to have that again. And also, since we've started since we put the DVD together in these past several months, we hadn't worked together for many, many years. And now we've been communicating all together and trying to make whatever decisions we can make. And we fell right back into those roles after not working together for so many years. We just were able to do it and without any major problems. And I think that speaks well, too.
So you've alluded to how this project has been reissued in DVD format. And on Thursday at Lewis and Clark at 4 p.m., during the Lewis and Clark Gender Studies Symposium, it's going to be shown. I believe it's a 20-minute DVD, which will have some of the interviews. Were these interviews were they transcribed or were they recorded interviews?
They were recorded.
They were recorded. So are the voices on this as well,
yes,
then? The
yes.
Women's voices are
yes.
on there.
Yes.
And then the selected photos to accompany that. And then four of your group is going to be speaking about the project.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. This Gender Studies Symposium, it's in its 25th year, and it begins on Wednesday, which is the day that this interview is being aired, and is free and open to the public.
When Good Work Sister originally debuted, we went to the Gender Symposium with it 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this is quite amazing,
yes,
to have it be, you know, still alive and revived and in this beautiful new format and still valuable. It's still, you know, useful material. A lot of the women that we interviewed have actually died in the meantime, and makes it all the more poignant.
Yes, and the issues are very timely, of course. I think, unfortunately, they always will be.
Is there an intended audience for this project?
Teachers.
Teachers, primarily. That's why the study guide was developed with it.
It's perfect for using in a classroom. Libraries, women's studies programs, World War II history,
mm-hmm.
oral history, any groups that do oral history and are interested in how that might be played out in a program.
We've had a lot of contact with other oral history projects around the country that were, you know, they're working on particular oral history projects and they were interested in ours. Initially, when the show first opened as a slide tape show, we got a lot of sales from to universities, women's studies departments all over the country, and it gave us a good feeling to know in March, you know, any year in March we were going to the show was going to be aired somewhere, and those women's voices will continue to be heard.
And you have a website that people could read more about this then?
Yeah,
we
have a fabulous website, goodworksister.org.
And then if people are interested in getting their own copy, or is there ability to rent this? Or
No, you could purchase it, but you just follow the links on the website, and it's pretty self-explanatory.
And is there anything else you'd like to share with us about this project that we haven't touched on yet?
Just think about how wonderful the quotes are in this show. And I think, I know it goes without saying unless someone has actually seen the show, but I'm encouraging the listeners to actually see the show, because you can't imagine the words that come out of these women's mouths. It's just remarkable.
I would just like to express my appreciation to the women who were so willing to talk to us and who had such a great story to tell, and we're so thrilled to be asked. It was such a thrill, as they say, mm-hmm. as one of them says, to be a young woman listening to these older women tell an important story in their lives. So I think Lynn has found a quote.
There are many quotes that we all love and are dear to our hearts, but I want to just mention Joanne Hudlicky's quote, and she said, "It was a challenge to me, and I just enjoyed it. It was the best thing I ever did in my life."
Well, thank you so much, Lynn and Tina, for coming in today and sharing with us about a fascinating time in the work history of women. And for people who have the time or are able to go to Lewis and Clark tomorrow, it is free, open to the public. You can check out on the Lewis and Clark website about the symposium. It's, let me see the name of it again.
The Gender Symposium.
And you can then hear more about it and see the images, hear the voices at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. And thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
Okay.
That's great.
And this is Judy Seastall with KVOO on International Women's Day.